You get out of here.
You get out of here.
This isn't for you.
Kill you.
Not this room.
This room isn't for you?
No.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. From Portland, Oregon, eating a steak or something, is my co-host Richard Wally.
Bluebird, actually, it featured in the film Nightcrawler. And from my co-host from sunny California, Cassidy Robinson.
What's a bluebird?
It's just these like really quick bag meals. And you just put them on the like stove with a little bit of water. You heat them up for maybe like, I don't know, like 10 minutes and they're ready.
Sure, bachelor's food.
Yeah.
Even though you're married.
Yeah, we eat bachelor's food all the time, though.
I'm 30.
You're 30? Do you feel 30?
I don't know.
Or do you feel 40?
I don't know. I'm kind of having a slight nervous breakdown about it, actually. I thought I was a lot more prepared. Like, I have this tradition every year. It's not a tradition, it's just the way I do things. Where about 5 months before my birthday, I just start rounding up. And I just tell people the age I'm going to be. Instead of, like, being a little kid and being like, I'm 29 and a half! I just say, like, oh, I'm 30. Because basically I am. And so I thought that I was, like, totally prepared. I thought, like, I felt all right saying it when I was 29.
Mm-hmm.
And then as soon as I was 30 and I was telling people I was 30, it felt a lot more real.
Did you? Well, okay, let me ask this, because I know some of your friends are younger than you.
Most of my friends, yes.
Yeah, in California.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe does that skew a little bit? Because we have like friends that are like a little over 30 here. So I'm like, it just doesn't seem like a deal.
Yeah, a lot of your friends are like, I guess, mixed age. No, I think it would bug me anyway.
You do have existential problems every minute or so.
I don't know. I guess the thing about 30 is a really big landmark year, a big landmark birth date. It's kind of been this horizon I've been seeing for a while, since about 24. And it's like this, I need to attain this, that, and the other by that year. And
okay. So you just feel like a failure to society is what you're telling me right now.
Not to society. Fuck society.
Okay. So to yourself, you haven't become
right.
A mogul.
I'm not a media mogul unto myself. No, that's not even necessarily my goal. I don't even know. I don't even have a clear picture of this, like, envisioned life that I should be living, other than, you know, more money than I have currently. Like, that would
being
be nice.
being more seriously, knowing you as a person, I was gonna say, I mean,
living like, more independently, yeah,
you've been kind of float a little bit through life, and that's not a bad thing. It's just, you know, I do too. I'm just saying,
I like to think that I float in a direction that I'm not. I mean, I have, like, you know, I put these little goals in front of me to try and accomplish, and so far I've done that. So I don't know, I guess everything's fine. It's just feel like, it's of all the birthdays I've had in a long time, this one has felt the most weighty in my brain.
So I mean, so the 30 is just,
it's just the sound of it, you know.
You're no longer in your 20s.
Yeah, you're no longer in your 20s. In your 20s you're allowed to be a fuck up.
Yeah, so now you're just feeling like you can't be
like
that
no
anymore.
I'm like, now I'm like, in every minute that I'm not getting my shit together is like, you know.
See, I feel like I've been practicing for too long being a fuck up that I don't think it will bother me.
Oh, just wait, Richard.
No, I don't think so.
That's what I thought too, 4 days ago.
4 days ago.
4 days ago, I would have said exactly what you just said. What When is your birthday?
I'm not going to tell you. No, I the only reason I know is because Skype told me of all things.
It's like midwinter, isn't it?
Midwinter? It is January 20th.
See? I kind of knew.
Yeah, you had a vague, in the right quarter.
Right. So you still have a little while. Enjoy it while it lasts, Richard. Go do something crazy between now and January, whatever you just said.
I'm really not worried, to be honest.
Go rob a bank. Go wow. Start a record label.
Actually, the robbing the bank thing is kind of on my bucket list. Like, not right. joking.
You'll wait till you're like 87 so that if you get like immediately shot on your way out of the bank, then you've at least led a good life.
No, because I already have a plan at my 85th birthday and how I'm dying.
Oh, a Viking or something? Like you have a planned death date?
Yes, when I'm 85, I'm going to be on have an Evel Knievel outfit on. I'm going to be on a dirt bike with a boombox attached to the front of it.
Okay.
Playing Tom Jones.
It's not unusual?
It's not exactly not unusual.
Okay.
And I'm going to drive off of the Grand Canyon as fast as I can.
All right.
Well, there will be a ramp. Okay. Like, if I make it, I make it. And that's just amazing. But if I don't, it's okay, too.
But 85, like, however many years from now that is going to be a lot different than 85 now. That's going to be, like, 60.
Well, then I might... Well, depending on technology, fine. We'll give it that. If there's a technology and I have to push it to, like, 120 or whatever, then okay, I'll do that. But for the foreseeable future, 85 seems like a good year.
Okay. Good deal.
You've lived a good, long, healthy life. See, I'm preparing to be 30. I wasn't like you. I didn't take it for granted.
Okay, let's go ahead and get on with the show. We'll start with the movie news, and I'll read my first one here. Christian Bale wants to reteam with director Michael Mann to do a biopic about Enzo Ferrari, the man who created the Ferrari. They kind of announced it at Telluride. And I guess they're sort of shopping the pitch around while they're going to these different festivals. We reviewed Mann's latest film, Black Hat, earlier in the year. And I think before the podcast, you were telling me that you were kind of trepidatious of this idea.
I am. I think his last couple of films have been, you know what, I liked Public Enemy.
Mm-hmm.
But there, and I think that there's a point to his, like, ugly... shoddy direct movie camera stuff that he does.
Yeah.
But then after we watched Black Hat, I was like, I don't know. This is just ugly. Why are you shooting it that way? Like, it's not even let it's... I mean, it was a little boring because it was just kind of boilerplate kind of thriller kind of thing.
Yeah.
But, man, the cinematography was so ugly, I had to, like, downgrade it, like, two grades just on that alone.
Right, for just... So, for how distracted and put out of the movie you were by the digital photography.
Yeah. What else was Christian Bale do with... Michael Mann.
They did Public Enemy.
Oh, yeah, he was in that. They kind of forget because he's like the least.
Yeah, I mean, he's kind of the main character, sort of Melvin Purvis, he's way. Like totally not as totally... as memorable as Johnny Depp in the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm kind of with you. I still want to give Michael Mann the benefit of a doubt, especially now that he has a flop under his belt, like a pretty bit significant one, where everyone was kind of saying the same thing. It's like, this looks bad. So
what are you doing with your camera, Michael Mann?
Right. So hopefully he's got it out of his system, and like he just kind of wants to go back. Again, this will be a period piece, so maybe that'll inspire him to use film again. I don't know. It didn't with Public Enemy, but...
No, I mean, he used film... I don't know. That film was interesting in and of itself and can be talked about in a good way, in a good light and a bad light, so...
Right.
I don't know. I'm trepidatious. I just...
And he has done movies on digital that look fine. I think his first movie he did on digital was Collateral, and that's one of my favorite movies of his. And I think, you know, the cinematography is a big part of the reason why that movie's cool. But not so much with the Black Hat.
Collateral worked in that kind of, like, noirish kind of way, but, I mean, it's even, I would even say now it's, in the day of DVD, if we can say that, I think that it was less distracting. I think it'd be really distracting now in 4K Blu-ray.
Right, yeah. That was a point of time when people were still trying to get digital to look like film as much as they could. And I'll actually be talking about that a little bit later when I review Tangerine, but I don't know really what to say about this. I don't really need a biopic about the guy who made Ferrari unless there's a really cool story in there. And maybe there is.
Maybe there's lots of cocaine.
Probably not, because this is like, the picture they have here looks like a pretty old photo. So we're t
That's back when it was legal. Nobody cared.
Oh yeah, I guess so then. Like Sherlock
Remember
Holmes
that?
cocaine, yeah.
Yeah, that Freud guy, he sure did a lot of it.
That explains a lot. Okay, what's your first story?
My first story is Dwayne Johnson is going to be doing a Jungle Cruise movie for Disney.
Our obligatory Dwayne Johnson casting news of the week.
Well, he's probably going to be in all of them too. They're all going to come out. They're all going to
All the
do
same,
reasonably
like
well.
they're gonna at some point this will happen. A Dwayne Johnson movie is gonna compete with another Dwayne Johnson movie
Or, well, they
on the same
do.
weekend.
I swear that happened this year, but it was like one came out one week and one came out the
Like
next.
2 weeks later, yeah.
But it did like semi okay.
I think
I
it
know
was
that
probably San Andreas and Furious 7 were
they were
probably
both
had a
around
little bit
this
of overlap on
close.
the box office.
Yeah, they did.
Yeah.
Anyways, that's I don't know. Let's get back into this specifically. So Jungle Cruise, this is one of the more like one of the older, cheesier, but more nostalgic rides at Disneyland. And you know what? They have these fun little really it what makes and breaks it is your like host on the little ride on
Yeah,
the little
your
boat.
tour guide.
Yeah, and if they're funny, the ride is a lot of fun. If they're not funny, it's not a lot of fun. Now, Dwayne Johnson being in it, he's a
Yeah.
charismatic guy. I'm not gonna lie. There's a reason he's being put in everything ever.
It's 'cause he kind of works. Yeah, I won't go so far as to say that like you can cast him as like, if they were to do like a Lolita remake and then put him in like the Peter Sellers part or something, that probably won't work. But when it comes to just like a good leading man who has a little bit of physicality, he's kind of your guy right now.
Well, and it's funny because even things that I can think of that weren't very good, like I can never attribute to him being bad.
Yeah, it's true.
I'm always like, he was pretty good at it. The
Like the
movie
last
was
G.I. Joe
stupid.
movie, yeah.
Well, he can be, well, that's the thing too, is like, he has like 2 out of 5 or something. So like 2 of his movies out of the 5 will suck, but the other 3 are good. So you're kind of like, well, his odds are good, so I'll try it. I didn't see San Andreas, so I can't
I
really
didn't
comment
either.
there, but
I read somewhere when I read the story about this Jungle Cruise movie. I heard that the person who's writing it is kind of taking inspiration from the Katharine Hepburn and Humphrey Bogart movie, The African Queen. So it'll have kind of like an old, like adventurer kind of jungle movie sort of vibe to it.
okay.
And that'll make I think that could make it fun. Or it could be Journey to the Center of the Earth.
It could be one of those things. So this is such this it's so up in the air
Yeah.
just because of what it is, the film studio that's making it, the star. Like it's mostly like it could be good, but we have no idea.
I think this will also make and break the idea of Disney doing any more movies based on their rides, because Tomorrowland super flopped. And I think like the last Pirates movie kind of underperformed.
They are bringing another
I
one,
know they're
so.
gonna keep they're gonna try that one more time, but I think if this movie does as bad as Tomorrowland, when and it very well could, I think that'll probably be the end of that.
Maybe it'll work a little better just going under that classical.
Yeah, period piece kind
Because Tomorrowland, that was a strange film. You
of.
just have to listen to our review to kind of hear our ups and downs of what we thought of it,
Yeah,
but.
that's a movie I still struggle with. Like, I still, like, my brain hasn't even, like, the penny still spinning hasn't landed yet on heads or tails.
Well, I know I'm not completely positive about it, but I can't say that it was all bad either. So,
Right.
anyway, what's your next article?
What is my next article? Oh, this is a big fat rumor. So, there's nothing set in stone for this yet, but word on the street is that they might be trying to get George Miller, who did, Mad Max Fury Road, well, all of the Mad Max movies, to direct, Man of Steel 2 for DC. Now, this would be kind of a ways away because they have a lot of projects that are slated before this, at least two or three. So this would probably be like 2019, something like that.
One thing that credits it, though, is that he did have a failed, before they went the Man of Steel route, they were going to do a Justice League movie that he was going to direct and had a lot of creative work down for it. And then as about when it was about ready to shoot, I mean, they had full cast, everything, and then they pulled the funding and they canceled it. So it had a lot to do with Batman and its being super, you know, serious and super grounded in reality.
Yeah.
And so they kind of didn't want to go more
over the top.
They kind of want, I think they really just wanted to cash in on Batman while the iron was hot. So,
and that's pretty much what they did. I mean, Man of Steel has Nolan's fingers all over it stylistically, even though he didn't direct it. It very much was made under that model until the end when it just decides to go batshit crazy and just blow up everything.
I think thinking back on that film, I think that's the weirdest thing for me isn't even that end scene. It's the fact that it's Nolan via Zack Snyder.
Zack Snyder's interpretation of Nolan, right.
Yeah, and it's not that... I think that one or the other on their own can be fine, but him doing Chris Nolan is just strange. It just doesn't, like, just, it screws with the tone. Because the whole time, that was my problem, was the tone. It might have to do with the coloring a little, too, I can be honest about
that. Did you see that video where they recolored it to make it look like a Superman movie?
Yeah, that's why I'm saying that, is because before, when anybody said that, I was like, okay, bullshit. That's so, like... such a nitpick little thing.
Yeah.
And then I saw those and I was like, no, it totally would have been better.
I mean, it would have, yeah, I don't think it would have saved the movie by any means. I mean, and I'm not even a hater of that movie per se. I think it's sort of fine for what it is. But
I'm exactly on the fence about it.
But yeah, I don't think that, you know, just recoloring it would have kept all the stuff that's problematic from being not problematic. But it also would have, like, made it maybe slightly more enjoyable in some parts. Yeah, I don't know. You know, I really just don't know what this franchise, what this world and expanded universe is trying to be yet. And I'm not sure if it knows.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm only good judging from trailers and one movie. And if like we've been talking, I think it's going to slowly drift further and further away from that Nolan-inspired take.
Oh, I think it already has.
Yeah, I mean, you can kind of already tell by the trailers for Batman vs. Superman, as well as Suicide Squad, already feel a lot different, a lot campier. So I don't know what this would be. But if it does, if they do drift far enough away from it, I could see the Mad Max George Miller having fun in that universe, especially if like somebody like Lobo was the villain.
Or Brainiac hanging from a tower with a guitar that shoots flames out of it.
Right. I mean, we can just only hope.
That picture that I see, and they have the guitarist from Mad Max and Superman. I'm like, yeah, I'd watch that movie.
Actually, I didn't mention at the top of the show, but for my birthday, I got to see the original Mad Max on 35mm over at the New Beverly.
Oh, yeah? How does it hold up?
I mean, it's... you've seen it in the 1979 Mad Max. It's crazy.
Yes. It's a little weird.
It's it's an exploitation motorcycle movie, and it's totally a different creature from the rest of that series. But it's kind of like on the big screen, especially, like it feels a lot more just like a wild ride.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like one thing after another in that kind of exploitation movie sort of way. But you can see his competency and like the way he does action scenes. It's like you can see like when he was able to get the budget to do Road Warrior, that he was able to, like, focus in on what his strengths are.
Mm-hmm.
So I likened it a lot to Evil Dead versus Evil Dead 2.
Well, like, hearing about that, too, and, like, random things, like, from what I understand, Like, yeah. He was trying to explain post-apocalypse to everybody. Well, there was like, no we're just going to make a...
for it. Yeah.
Well, especially in film, there wasn't a lot. Mm-hmm. But he kept trying to explain, and they're like, well, we're going to make a motorcycle movie because we have all these, like, bikers.
Right.
So that's essentially what they ended up doing more of. But
and I was also thinking about when we were walking out of the theater and we were kind of talking about it because, you know, a lot of the people I was with had only seen Fury Road. And that movie right. is like, it's like, that is such a disparity of style between those two movies. But I think it's kind of interesting to think about it in canon if you want to like include everything and, more than they probably actually do exist. But to think of like how much apocalypsing is happening between movies. Right. It's kind of like really depressing to see, like, it's kind of green and there's trees and there's still water and society's like at least 75% still there in the first movie. And then by the time you get to Road Warrior, it is like pure full on apocalypse cannibals eating each other. Right. And then between Thunderdome and Fury Road, it seems like it's even doubled even more because the resources isn't gas anymore. It's water. Mm-hmm. but anyway, I digress. So I guess
that was important. We need to talk about Mad Max every other
chance
episode.
We get.
Yes.
I do recommend seeing, that in a theater if you can though. It's a fun midnight movie kind of romp.
Okay.
We're not going to be able to get to the, Netflix homework today, and I know Patrick is going to be upset by that because that's his favorite segment, and it's a lot of people's favorite segment.
It's my favorite segment. I'm upset.
Yes, it's at least two people's favorite segment.
Yes, two people's. That's a lot for our podcast. Thank you.
Right. The Thief, the Cook, His Wife, and Her Lover. We'll have to review that next week because the dog ate my homework. But in place of it, I wanted to pose a dumb little question.
Okay.
And it's kind of a trip back to memory lane. I like to do this every once in a while. Talk about our formative movie years. And I know our answers for this question are going to be wildly different. Was there a movie where you really wanted to see something as a child, but for whatever reason you weren't allowed? And it became like this thing that you'd built up in your head in one way or another. Or maybe it wasn't even necessarily, in your case, not allowed, because I know that your mother was a lot more permissive than my parents. But maybe it was something you couldn't get to for whatever reason for a long time.
Oh, yeah, there was tons of stuff money-wise.
Right.
I mean, renting videos was okay. Going to the movies was like a laugh, because that was expensive. That was for rich people.
I didn't go a lot. I mean, even as a kid, I probably went to the movies 5 or 6 times a year. Until I was a teenager and I had sort of my own money, I could start going more often.
Right.
But yeah, I guess that's... Was there like a movie or maybe a TV show that you were told, like, you can't watch that yet? And so it became like this, like, holy grail.
No. Like, I'm sorry. I'm trying to really, participate, and I'm just like... Not really, no. Only thing I can think of is, and it's with good purpose, Toxic Avenger 2.
Okay.
My mom made me stop watching that.
She was watching with you?
No, she came downstairs and it was just, you know, they were like in a bathhouse or something. And I was like, oh my gosh.
Just boobs and
I was always
everywhere.
Drawn to Toxic Avenger because, you know, it's a superhero, essentially. And at that time period, we always talk about that. That time period was like, you know, this hunger for it. And even as a kid, I was like, I need this. I need a superhero movie. And so I turned to the Toxic Avenger. The first one scarred me. It was one of the first films I saw and just kind of, I was like, no, this isn't right.
You were morally outraged by it at like 7 years old. It's like,
no, there's specifically a scene. I'm not going to ruin it for anybody, but there's a scene in a and for those of you who have seen the unrated version, there's a scene in a like sauna where a girl does a thing, and it's just not okay. Like, I mean, as an adult, like, I'm like, okay, like, I get the appeal.
Yeah.
But, like, that was the first time, like, as a child, I was like, wow, they're really pushing the limits here. And rightfully so. As an adult, I think they do. And it's on purpose, so it's fine.
I guess.
But that was the first kind of time that that's about as close as I can get with that kind of question.
Well, how far were you in the movie before you were told to turn it off?
Like a good 45 minutes, like an hour.
Right. Were you able to finish it?
Yes. I've seen that whole series. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, except for the newest one, but.
Yeah. Like Citizen Doxy and some of those ones.
Yeah. One of those I haven't seen.
But. Yeah. Was it, when you finally returned to it, was it, I don't know.
No,
vexing? By that time, did you get something out of it?
No, by that time it was like I was too far down the road. Like nothing fazed me. That was the teenage years, and you would have to go very far. Maybe some of like the like super gory like Japanese or Korean films that they have out now might have like got to me, but
yeah,
you know, I was showing people like Texas Chainsaw and like the sequels and. So, I don't know.
You were a little gore hound.
I was. And I loved shocking other people and making them feel bad about the world.
You like to inflict movies on people, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I do too, so I've no way of making fun of you for that. Yeah, I mean, my upbringing was quite different. I was raised in a largely religious household for a long time. And so, and it, like, the intensity of that religiousness would come and go in peaks and valleys. No, but because of that, there was different periods of time where the clamps were tightened more than others. And it was kind of weird and arbitrary. Like, one year this would be okay, and then the next year it wasn't, and then the next year it was. Sometimes we would change churches, and therefore, like, interpretations of things would be different, and therefore they would like decide to be more relaxed about things, and then it would change again. And so it was kind of like there was one period where I wasn't allowed to see movies I'd already seen. like they were okay like the year before, and I was like, and then they were like, oh no, we're not doing that anymore. And it's like, well, I remember there was a period when I wasn't allowed to watch The Simpsons, even though we had seen like two seasons together as a family. So that kind of gives you the backdrop. And it's kind of a dumb movie to be a Holy Grail movie. Mm-hmm. It's a dumb movie to be a lot of different kinds of movies. But I for a long time, I wasn't allowed to see Mortal Kombat. Because this was during the period of time when, like, the religious right was really hardcore against, like, that game. And they were putting all this stuff about how violent it was and how fucked up it was. And how it was going to turn every kid into a murderer. And, but this was also at the time when the game was at its most popular. And I was like super into it because ninjas.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really excited about the movie because ninjas.
Yeah, right.
And yeah, because it was like just at this like horrible timing that the bad press, probably because of the movie's release, was going up against the bad press of the video game. And I wasn't allowed to see it for something like a year after it was released, and I kept like trying to like go to friends' houses and stuff and be like, let's get this, and they'd be like, I already saw it. And, like, let's get this instead. Let's rent Tommy Boy again. It's like, but I really gotta see this now. You don't understand. Like, I have to do this a certain way. And then eventually I saw it and it's whatever, you know. But I mean, I guess I probably loved it at the time because of that pressure and that waiting,
sure,
to see it,
and because you were a kid and
I was a kid, I mean, and whatever. And you know, the grand irony of ironies is that the movie is nothing like as violent as the video game.
No, not
it's
even
PG-13, and I would say kind of a soft PG-13 at that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of made for kids, actually. Like, if you see the movie now, like, the dialogue and, like, the characters and stuff, there's a little bit of, like, risque humor every once in a while. But for the most part, you know, the violence is really tampered down. And it's kind of a kids-ish, Ninja Turtles-ish vibe movie.
Hmm. See, the closest I ever got is I got in a lot of trouble because we had, like, $10 late fee. Mm-hmm. And that was the closest I ever got to movies taken away. I couldn't go to the movie store for a while after that.
Well, that's kind of a different story.
Yeah, that was my own fault.
Yeah, that might actually have been totally warranted.
Well, it was supposed to be a friend was supposed to take it back, and they didn't. And yeah, whatever.
Whose responsibility was it, Richard? It's not your friend's responsibility.
It was. I left it with him, and he said he would take it back. He lied to me. I learned an important lesson.
That friends lie all the time.
All the time. They will let you down.
No, I mean, I probably like have 17 stories exactly like that one, but that's the one that I remember the most. All right. Well, that was fun. What? Let's go ahead and get into the reviews. Today we're going to be reviewing The End of the Tour, which is a small indie film. And then before that, I'm going to review Tangerine, which is even smaller. Tangerine is directed by Sean Baker, and this is something like his fifth film. He's sort of semi-known in the world of micro-budget indies, and this is probably the smallest movie he's made thus far. It's really well-known, or not well-known, but it's being talked about a lot for a few things in particular. One being the subject matter. It's a story about two transgendered prostitutes who work out of West Hollywood on the corner of like Santa Monica and somewhere, and run their business through a donut shop that actually exists. It's not like they built a set. I can go to said donut shop after I record this podcast. And it's both of the characters who are in the movie who play the lead prostitutes are transgendered actresses as well. So they're not, and they're untrained actors. It's the first movie they've ever been in. They were kind of discovered before the shooting of this film. The second reason why everyone's talking about this movie, or why some people are talking about this movie, is because it was all shot on an iPhone. Hmm. Or a few iPhones. I think when I saw an interview, he said that they'd bought 3 and ended up using 2. And a lot of the locations were kind of stolen, you know. Now they didn't get a lot of like permits and, you know, permission to shoot. I mean, they, you know, like the donut shop, like they would just ask like the owners if it was cool if they. But apparently, like the people who were working at the donut shop, like they were like, "Fine, you can shoot here, but we still have to run a business. So if a customer comes in, you have to stop."
I think that's fair.
Yeah, totally fair. You know, I can make production a little rough, and I assume it probably did. The basic story here is that there is our main character, played by Katana Kiki Rodriguez, plays Cindy, who's just been released from jail. She's been there for about a month, and she's looking for her pimp/boyfriend, and finds out from her best friend, Alexandra, another one of these prostitutes who works the same corner, that he's been cheating on her while she was away. So she ain't gonna have none of that. And the two of them kind of go on a wild adventure, looking for this pimp. And it kind of becomes a One Crazy Night type of indie comedy. Yeah, one of the interviews I listened to with Sean Baker, he did a pretty interesting interview, if anyone cares, on the Brett Easton Ellis podcast. And he was talking about how, like, you could take this same plot device and set it sort of anywhere. It could be a girl who comes home from summer camp and finds out that her boyfriend was cheating on her in high school. And you could use the same mechanics to tell a much, you know, broader appealing story. But because of his subjects, because of the fact that he uses non-trained actors, because of the fact that he's using an iPhone to shoot it, and I should say it's not just like point and click like we would use an iPhone. He downloaded specific kind of apps so that it could be in widescreen and so that the coloring can be altered. He can add film grain, that type of stuff. And of course he uses like these different kinds of expensive snap-on lenses that, you know, can do like anamorphic and that kind of stuff as well. So the movie looks like a movie. It doesn't look like, you know, the VHS shaped upside down rectangle thing that you usually see on iPhone footage. It's actually a really kind of wide, wide screen, and the colors are really, like, the way he shoots it is he kind of lets everything kind of blow out. Like, the sun is constantly kind of in the shot in a way that kind of overexposes and on purpose in a sort of stylish way. And, like, you know, the greens are very green. The sunset of the LA sunset, that's, you know, caused mostly because of smog and filth and grime. Has that, like, bright tangerine, I'm sure that's where we get the name of the movie, sort of color in the background as the movie goes. And it kind of has, you know, this wild sort of jump cutting and that kind of stuff all throughout the movie, as well as I guess he commissioned a bunch of online musicians to feature their own music in it. Get cheap score, basically. And it's a lot of kind of this rambunctious, high-energy sort of techno stuff that runs through the thing. So the movie is just, like, moving, 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 as, you know, she's on this furious journey to find this pimp, and she's running into all of these, you know, all of this different squalor and, you know, the alleys of Hollywood. And one of the reasons I like the movie, among a lot of reasons why I think it's pretty neat, is that you get to see a side of LA that a lot of movies don't show. You know, a lot of movies, especially movies that are shot in and around Hollywood, you know, you get the grand kind of movie star version of that. But the reality is there's a few streets that are kind of nice, and a lot of it is pretty gross. A lot of it is, you know, a ton of poverty, a lot of, you know, struggling people, a lot of homeless people, a lot of hustlers who are trying to, you know, sell their next show or concert or whatever. You know, it's one of those kind of cities. And this is the version of LA you see in this movie, is this kind of the outcasts eye view of it. Most of the characters in this movie are the ones you would cross the street so you don't have to encounter. And that's kind of brilliant, because you're sort of forced to be in this world and live in this world throughout the whole movie. And on top of it, these two actors that have never been in anything prior to this movie, there's a kind of roughness to their abilities, I'll say, in a way that is obvious that it's unprofessional, but also kind of adds to that grit and energy that the movie already has.
Kind of like in a Clark sort of way, I'm going to assume.
A little, yeah, I mean, I would say a little bit more on a specific rhythm than Clerks. I think, it, you know, the movie's cut really, really wildly. The shots are really ambitious. You know, a lot of whips and stuff. Like, it, you know, it's a little, but it does have kind of, it, to me, this reminded me a lot of the type of indie film that came from the 90s. Like, this feels less like an indie film you'd get now and more like something you'd get around, like, 95, 96, around the time of, like, Larry Clark's Kids. And that type of stuff. It has a sort of a documentary-ish vibe to it. But it's also super funny. You know, this is largely a comedy. It's a comedy that takes place in kind of a dark world. But it's, you know, it is funny. And these, you know, you get the vibe that there's a lot of, like, improvisation here, because they're talking so fast and they're oftentimes talking over each other and that type of stuff. But you know, there's apparently a lot of this was really tightly scripted as well because of the budget. So I recommend it. I think it's kind of an interesting film, if nothing else. And it's a world you normally don't get to see. And it's, you know, for the, its experimentation of, you know, using the iPhone and stuff. And that is an interesting aspect of it, but I hope that people don't just remember it because of that as a gimmick. Because I think it is a good movie.
Ready for our next review, sir?
Yeah.
Would you like me to start?
Yeah, sure. You can set it up.
Okay. The End of Tour is a film starring Jason Segel and Jesse Eisenberg for the most part. It's directed by James Pulsett. It's about the writer David Foster Wallace, and he's being interviewed by the actual interviewer David Lipinski from Rolling Stone. And basically, the setup is David Lipinski is sent to interview him And they go on this little book tour together. David Foster Wallace's big book, The Infinite Jest, has just come out, and they're just starting to kind of bud as a, you know, as a book star, if you will.
Right.
Now the film is just basically just a talking head movie.
Uh-huh.
There's not really much more like of a plot to it,
mm-hmm.
but to vaguely quote Jason Segel's David Foster Wallace character, it's existential guilt to his very butthole. Now, this film was really funny. I think it's shot really well. And I love both of the performances.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you like Talking Heads movies or can at least stand it, this is one of the better ones I've ever seen even. I think it's a really great movie. I really do have to say Jason Segel was really great in it.
Mm-hmm.
He sold both the funny aspects of the character and the really, you know, darker aspects to the character.
The more complicated stuff, yeah.
Mm-hmm. The deeper motivations there. Jesse Eisenberg was Jesse Eisenberg, and that works for this film. and I mean, other than that, I guess there were a few other little characters here and there, but
yeah, there's a few side characters, peripheral characters we meet along the way, but it's really a two-handed game.
Yeah, Joan Cusack was funny.
Yeah, she was as their taxi cab driver.
There's a word for it. Specifically.
A handler or something like that. Yeah.
Well, no, it just drives them around.
Yeah.
Chauffeur.
Chaperone. Yeah.
So she was a small part, but basically you're just talking about those two things. But I think how it ties together really is in their conversations about, and some of it felt so, it was interesting because this is like, you know, a period piece.
Yeah, it takes place in the mid-90s.
Right. But there are things that they say about our time right now that are like so profound and sort of weird, like especially when they're talking like about pornography and stuff like that and mm-hmm. how you'd have to be like off of the planet once it. There's a lot of dark humor also because of the writer's eventual end. But
right.
It's sort of interesting because you get a little glimpse into a lot of different things. And I feel like, you know, usually when they talk about somebody's depression or whatever, and they talk about, or they even kind of mention any kind of mental instability, they always really, really like try to make the person look really crazy. But I love this because it was about a really actually normal person
mm-hmm.
and that has a very normal disease that kind of takes a lot of managing.
Yeah.
And it affects your life. And the worst part about it is people always kind of end up trying to hold it over you.
Mm-hmm.
And so I found all of the different aspects and all the different little things. It all worked to me. And I never felt in this film like I was like, oh, this is the life lesson part. Like it flowed well and it just, I don't know. I really liked this film. How did you feel?
I liked it too. I think I was talking a little bit about it with my friends over the weekend. Somebody brought it up and I said, you know, the thing about this movie is that it's really small
mm-hmm.
and it's really unassuming. And it's not beating you over the head with anything really.
Right.
You know, there are for a biopic, there if you even really want to call it that, there's doesn't have those like grand arcs that we usually see in these things, and the character is never like punctuating these character defining speeches or whatever. Even though a lot of this movie is dialogue, and a lot of the things that he's saying does very directly inform the character, but it's never in a way that feels like this is what the movie's about.
Right.
So I think because of that, I think there is an audience who will see this movie and feel that it's very inconsequential, that it doesn't really mean very much as a whole. And I personally don't feel that that's what the movie is and that, but I can see that some people might see that because the movie is not begging you to love it. in a way. It's sort of the stuff that I like in the movie a lot is the subtleties. It's, you know, there is a lot that's being said in the dialogue, and, you know, the movie's sort of framed with all of these interviews. Like, every time they start talking, David Lipsky, played by Jesse Eisenberg, you know, is it okay if I record this? And then, you know, he'll hit the record button and they start talking. So you know that probably at least a third of the dialogue is transcribed. But it's a lot of my favorite stuff in this movie, especially the interactions between the two, is the silent stuff. You know, the way that, like, you know, they meet a girl or whatever, and then there's, like, these subtle jealousies that start to play out that's never really said because they don't really know each other well enough to feel like there's any real betrayal happening, but it still has that, you know, dynamic there, and they kind of, you know, just the way they kind of look at each other across the room, and you get everything said with just a glance or just the way that the characters behave toward one another.
Well, it seems much more naturalistic, I would say, than in a movie where it's like, oh, you, how dare, you know? Yeah. I mean, there's kind of a confrontational moment, but they don't do it so overboard, you know? It's that, you know, how would you talk to, like, a stranger, or even I would say even a friend. Like, you don't see these moments where it's like these huge blowouts unless the person is, you know, half crazy or
drunk or just an asshole. Yeah.
Drunk, asshole.
Like, people who, all of those most things. People don't want to have confrontations. Especially right. These characters, who are both kind of shy and introverted anyway. But, you know, the obvious parallel here is that you have Jason Segel's character, the David Foster Wallace, who's just on the precipice of becoming, or has just barely become, a literary superstar. And he's having, like, this Kurt Cobain guilt over it, because he just wants to be a regular guy, and he isn't ready to deal with being a superstar. And then you have Jesse Eisenberg, who's a working writer, and he's making more money than writers make nowadays. But he wants that thing. He wants that thing that David Foster Wallace has. And you know, during their interviews, he's kind of, he's asking him all of, like, the question he needs to get the article. But he's also asking a little bit, like, what is it like on the other side? because I'm peeking over the fence and I really want to be over there.
But what's interesting is it goes both ways.
Mm-hmm.
Because Jesse Eisenberg's character has, like, the girlfriend he calls a home, and he has all these other things. And they even kind of talk about these things without talking about these things.
Right.
They kind of talk about how, you know, that competing with how in American culture, how it even affects, you know, Gen Xers, even probably millennials, how it is keeping up with the Joneses. It might not be the exact same because we're not able to buy three bedroom households or anything like that. But it shows it in an interesting way. Mm-hmm. And with characters who are very much real people, and it's interesting because they never cast them in good, bad light. It's always like, these are just people. This is just happening in a lot of ways.
Well, I think it helps that you have, you know, two very capable actors in this part. And, I will say that Siegel's doing most of the heavy lifting as far as, like, playing this character who already, you know, David Foster Wallace was a real writer who really did commit suicide. And that has been a part of his legacy ever since. You know, he's kind of seen as this, you know, tragic person. And the movie, in a way, is trying to demystify that, but at the same time sort of honor his legacy.
Mm-hmm.
And so because of that, you know, Jason Segel, who up to this point has never really been known for playing terribly dramatic parts, he has a lot to carry here, and he does fantastically. Mm-hmm. Eisenberg has kind of a thankless role in that he has to play opposite of this and be able to let Segel be all of those complex things, while at the same time, you know, working as a foil in an interesting way. And I think that he's talented enough that he's able to do that and make it look like he's not doing that much work, even though that, in some ways, maybe even takes more work.
I guess. I mean, I didn't see it that way. I just saw it as a Jesse Eisenberg character. Because
it's not like a wildly different thing that he's, like, you know, disappearing into a different personality. I'm just saying, like, his role in the scene of, you know, dealing with dialogue and letting Segel be able to guide a scene.
Well, sure. No, and it wasn't a criticism at all, because it's a wonderful performance. Mm-hmm. He's just one of those actors. When you hire Jesse Eisenberg, you know what you're getting.
Right.
You know, he isn't this, you know, man of many faces or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that that's bad. He just has to be cast well. And in this particular film, I think he's cast very well. And I feel like their charisma works kind of impeccably. I don't know. I really love this film. I think that if you like Talking Heads films, I think people should see it.
It reminded me a lot of, in style, like the way it's written and the way it kind of plays out. It reminded me a lot of like a Linklater film, where people are just kind of like, you know, like the Before Sunrise trilogy, where people are just kind of like talking things out and like, you know, talking about life and philosophy and like how they, you know, feel about the world around them at that moment. And you know, the characters are sort of built around what isn't being said a lot of the time. So yeah, no, I like this movie a lot. I won't say that I loved it. And I don't exactly know why. It could be that smallness that I'm talking about it, that it's such a personal film and it's such a specific, direct, pinpointed story, and, you know, under such a finely tuned microscope, that it feels, I guess, lack of a better word, a little inside baseball.
Well, you self... See, I didn't feel the inside baseball. Since you're a self-identified neurotic,
sure,
you say it quite often. I don't feel like I'm outing you or anything.
No,
you couldn't kind of get behind what they were saying.
No, I mean, I was very much enjoying it. I mean, I like the movie. Don't get me wrong. I'm just saying maybe it's because of just the ambition of what the movie is. Ultimately, it doesn't rise beyond like something I would recommend, like, oh yeah, if you haven't seen it, you should. It's interesting performances. You should watch. You should see it. But I can't, like, it's not like an end of the year must see for me. And I don't 100% know why.
Hmm.
I enjoyed it though.
Oh, see, for me, it's kind of the opposite, because I usually actually don't. I don't know if I usually get into these kind of films as often. They're kind of just Talking Heads, and I
No, it's yeah, this weird is usually the opposite reaction. I think I yeah. would. This is usually more kind of my bread and butter. And I'm not. It's not that it isn't here. I do recommend the movie. I just, like. I guess what I'm saying is that I think you'll like it more specifically. And you know, I'm not saying this applies to everybody, but I think specifically somebody will like it more if they already know who David Foster Wallace is or have read Infinite Jest. And or have a pretty good idea of like what his legacy as a writer was.
Oh, see, I didn't. I mean, I vaguely knew who he was. Mm. I knew he was that writer that killed himself
and wrote a big book.
Yeah, what?
And wrote a
and
big
he book. Wrote a really big book. Yes.
Yeah,
those are the two things I knew about him. But to be honest, I do find this quite weird, because usually our reactions to this kind of film would be opposite. But I feel like this film is tighter than normal, like, Talking Head films. And I feel like it has a little bit more, is a little bit more competently made. Even than somebody yeah. like, even though I think Richard Linklater is a very capable and great director, I think that this film is a little stronger than most of the films I've seen of his. And I think I enjoyed it more than probably any of his Talking Head films that I've seen. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know. I don't know why. This is confusing to me. I feel like I need to get to the bottom of it, but there's like no way to like.
Right. Well, and a little bit. I mean, for me, a little bit. It's faded over time. Like coming out of the theater, I was a lot more pumped about it than I've been over the last few weeks since I've seen it.
Oh, I could watch it again now. Like, I mean, it's been 4 days, and I'm pretty. Mm-hmm. I'm usually pretty gauged like the next day.
Right.
If I think just training from the podcast is like, does this fade? And this one, I really don't think will for me. I don't know what it is about it specifically, but I just tap into it. It you know what? And I really do feel like the dialogue is super punchy in it.
It is.
And maybe that's why I attach to it. So.
Probably, like I said, about half transcribed from those actual interviews that were on tape, and about half filled in with, you know, conjecture or whatever they felt like the scene needed at that time. Right. And it's pretty seamless as far as that goes. Like, I can't tell, like, oh, this part's clearly stuff that was on tape, and this stuff feels more written. Like, it all is of a piece. And it's competently made. I'm not saying, you know, I'm not trying to say that it's not a good movie. I, for whatever reason, I'm not over the moon about it, but I do think that it's a really good actor showcase.
Right. I'm trying to figure out, like, again, it's more the oddity of the situation.
Of why we
it's
traded like, brains this week? Yeah. I don't know.
I'm more perplexed by that. And I feel like, I don't know, if we had something to like, I don't know, we should
do brain scans
or something to see what the problem is.
Do you think that Jason Segel could get a nomination for this? Not that any movie should be concerned with that, but...
His performance, yeah.
Yeah, I'd probably say that too.
See, that's funny, because you're not arguing any of like the points. You're like, yeah, that's all true. I just don't really like it that much.
I
know how you feel sometimes.
For me, I mean, I guess if I'm like, you know, if I want to go there or whatever, I feel kind of B+ about it.
I don't know if I would score it maybe even that much higher. Mine would be like an 89.9. Oh, no. I really did like this film. I don't know. It's hard to gauge because this isn't usually my bread and butter like we're talking about. So.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so I don't really feel like I would probably, if you know, pushed me, I'd say like a B+ as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I enjoyed this as much as like any of the other films that I really love this year. So I don't know. It's odd.
All right. Good. Well, I mean, that's a positive review, I would say, from both of us. And I would say, yeah, if you're a fan of like the Linklater stuff, or you're a fan of like My Dinner with Andre, or even the first Clerks to a certain extent, like that is kind of the world this movie sort of lives in. It's very low key, but it's definitely interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's going to be the show for us since we don't have any Netflix homework, but next week we will try and get to The Cook, The Thief, The Wife, and Her Lover.
I feel like we're doing something wrong. I feel very bad. I want you to know that. You've made me feel very bad this episode. I feel like I've done something wrong. I'm being punished for something.
No, I'm punishing myself. Okay, and if anybody has anything to say about any of the movies we talked about this week, whether it be The End of the Tour or Tangerine, if you happen to see it, or the Netflix homework for next week, you can email us at jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/jabberpodcast, where we post all of our news stories, some of which we don't get to on the show. You can also find us on Twitter at jabberpodcast, all one word. And you can find us and subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher Radio. And if you're there, please leave us a 5-star rating and a 1-sentence review. We're also searchable under the Zune and Windows Podcast Network, as well as Pocket Cast. You can read my movie reviews that I post weekly at the Idaho State Journal at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. You can find some of the reviews I've done over at the Seattle-based website, MacGuffin, at mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. Richard had a blog once upon a time that he hasn't been to for a while, but it's there if you want to see it at rdwally.weebly.com.
And that's a good way. I like your new introductions. They make me feel better.
Just be brutally before, I felt honest. Like,
I feel like that's better because it makes me feel like, you know, that's the truth. Thank you for telling the truth to people. Because before it seemed like you were trying to urge me to put more content on. I'm like, I won't do it, Cassidy. Can't make me.
But if you ever decide to, that's where they'll do it. Be sure to listen to our friends, Brad, Amanda, and Alyssa over at Quarter Life Crisis, quartercrisis.podbean.com. You can listen to Leland over in Olympia, Washington, at his comedy podcast, dampercast.com. And be sure to check out Patrick and his dad over in Detroit, at Make Dad Read Comics, and we will be doing a guest episode sometime in the beginning of next month, and we will announce that and post it probably on Facebook, which is another reason why you need to be there. Okay, bye.
Bye.